Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Nicholson Baker, the author most recently of a collection, The Size of Thoughts, Essays and Other Lumber, published by Random House. He's the author as well, of course, of The Mezzanine, Room Temperature, Vox, You and I, The Fermata. And I always feel happy when he's here because he's one of the writers whose work, no matter what its subject, is led by its language. And frequently, these essays turn on the possibilities that language systems offer. The happiest I've ever been, a John Updike title, was the couple of hours I spent reading your essay about the disappearance of card catalog draws, and I wanted to thank you for mourning their passing.
Ooh, I had just finished writing The Fermata, and I had a kind of a feeling that I had a lonely life as a fiction writer. I had an office, and I went there and spent all day writing, and I missed office life, and the logical thing to do seemed to be to call up librarians and ask them if they were throwing out their card catalogs, and to my shocked, my horror, really, they all were, and I kind of felt that they shouldn't, that was a mistake, that they were flunking a crucial test. If they can't take their own history seriously, then can we trust them to preserve other pieces of the past that are of value to us?
Well, one of the scary moments in this history is that I visited with the then head of the Beverly Hills Library, who asked me if I wanted to take a draw or two home with me.
Well, sometimes they want to give away the cards but keep the cabinets because the cabinets have resale value. Apparently they fit audio cassettes fit in them kind of well. So it's often there's this urge on their part to dump all the cards and then sell the actual wood to antique dealers. It's a very strange set of priorities.
The subject of what is being left behind seems to be one of your cherished subjects. All sorts of disjectra occupy this book, including occasional deleted letters from other manuscripts and things like that. What makes you affectionate toward the neglected and soon to be lost?
I don't know what kind of flaw in my character makes me. I like the underappreciated, and I mean, I always like to study, say, the tracks left by tractor tires, and I like getting at very big-ish ideas, but through circuitous routes. And sometimes if you pick a narrow subject like the disappearance of a certain form of hybrid punctuation, you can get at some larger change in language as a whole, but with a kind of more useful concreteness. Maybe I'm just a sentimental guy, and I happen to love my college's card catalog, which was filled with handwritten cards. And when I called the director of the library up, he was throwing them out. And then the Rochester Public Library, the one I used when I was growing up, threw theirs out. And then the other one, beloved catalog that I used, which was the one at the University of California, Berkeley, the subject catalog, worked on by hundreds of people, was thrown out. And it's of course it's a symbolic thing. It's out of date. But what's wrong with symbolism? These things stand for all of books, and all the little pieces of the typos that get deleted when you're writing, say. The problem with the computer is that you sometimes lose those. So it seemed important to preserve them as a kind of found poetry at the bottom and actually print them to say, this is a piece of the past too, all the things that are lost from a manuscript when you correct the typos.
Well, I had received that essay in that collection, which was called Outtakes, and it was sort of perfect. Everyone else was providing deleted chapters and the results of heroic battles with presumably hateful editors, but yours was the computer's recollection of the particular throwouts on Father's Day.
The interesting thing is the form that the rejected material takes. It's a mirror image of the completed draft because the typos that happen first are the ones that are at the bottom of the page. So it's this kind of sinister residue that grows out. And it's like a lagoon of all the things that could go wrong. I thought that was kind of a useful document, just kind of frightening, really, to see the things. It's always risky to show the bad phrasing that you almost included, but sometimes you got to take risks. I don't know.
the subject of all of these essays, and in fact of the books as well, seems eventually at some remove to be the melancholy of the writer. There's a sadness that accrues to the writer of Vox and Fermata. One almost feels, you know, oh, the imagination has done him in. He's lost in a frenzy. And here, too, another kind of melancholy, the melancholy of the bookworm, you know, the late afternoon of a bookworm. But it made me wonder whether, say, De Quincey, too, knew that the result of his essay would be to create De Quincey.
That the result of his essay on the opium eater, any essay.
Any of his essays, the way he wanders around in labyrinthine structures, the way in his essay on suicide you can see that the subject disturbs him so much that he'd rather talk about anything else and finally asks, do goats commit suicide and climbs an Alp to see? You know, you sense here is someone whose very inclination is to create an essay that will show him avoiding life, avoiding his subject, moving further away from disgruntlement. And I wondered how long it has been known that writing creates its author.
It may be true. It feels when I'm writing as if I'm just kind of pulled along by – I seem to be one of those unfortunate people who, as soon as I focus on a given topic, it starts to become the most important thing that ever was thought about. And while I'm under the trance of following out all the details of that topic, nothing else exists, which is why I chose in the Fermata this idea of stopping time. But in the case of these essays, when I was in the middle of tracing the etymology of the word lumber, instead of feeling as if I was creating some kind of residual self or something, I just felt that there was nothing that could possibly be as interesting as the permutations of this word lumber and the chasing down of the word wherever it might hide in the library.
Well, it was interesting to me because, you know, it used to be that essays on a word would begin with the attempt to prove that the word means itself and its opposite. And so Freud, for instance, following German philological tradition, in his essay on the uncanny, the unheimlich, the unhomelike, the literal meaning of the word, begins to reveal that both the heimlich and the unheimlich, the loved and the frightening, are the same thing. Mm. And I thought as I was reading the essay on lumber that there, you know, a similar, who needs deconstruction?
Yeah, well, I've never mastered deconstruction, so I've just given up and tried in a way to go back to an old-fashioned kind of scholarship in which you kind of follow what's there. But it's true that lumber, which in its old-fashioned meaning just means stuff. Now, that the first English dictionary defines lumber as old stuff, and it came from the Lombard pawnbrokers who had Lombard houses or lumber houses where they would take whatever was pledged when they gave out money. So it had to do with pawnbroking. But that sense of money and wealth and preciousness and yet of old things being stored, and so the kind of confusion about whether you're in a place that's of worthless things or of the things that really are just dying to be described at that moment, which is what the writer always confronts, was what interested me, I guess. Are we, you know, is a writer, when he's picking a subject, is he looking at a piece of lumber, or is he looking at something infinitely precious? And he only finds that out by trying to wrap a paragraph around it.
I'm curious, are you fond of the instructional films that Robert Benchley made? Do you know them?
I love the way that sort of the question, it comes in as it's like one of those dipping swallow flights. There's this great passage in William Maxwell's story I just read. Someone was saying, it's funny how they say as the crow flies, because when you look at the way the crow flies, it always goes in these large leisurely circles, you know. But I've seen one Benchley film, How to Do Something, How to Put on Spats. I can't remember what it was. But I loved his expression. I mean, there's just a certain kind of slightly animated look in his eyes, but deadpan and funny. I think he's a wonderfully funny man. But there's also the sadness of the guy who is in Hollywood sort of at the end of his writing career moving to something that he has less respect for and all that. Why do you ask?
Because suddenly, as you were speaking, I thought of Benchley narrating or pretending to be the professor who is giving a lecture called The Sex Life of the Polyp. And, you know, he's a bit embarrassed that the polyp should have a sex life at all. And also, there is something genuine. There's a space between the professor and the humorist that is co-occupied. He's not making fun, really, of professors, because as a humorist, he's had to take a funny word like polyp over and over again and ask whether the word has a sex life. And it seemed to me suddenly that that's what you do. That's what you do.
my secret, clammy secret is that I would like to be thought of as something of a scholar when I do these, when I kind of trace the history of a word like lumber. But I also want it to be funny, because I think always the scholars, the great classical scholars, the Renaissance scholars, were having fun when they were searching, tracking down a word and amending a text. There was a kind of glee in it, and there was also a fierceness when they would have these incredible battles. But it is funny. I mean, it's scholarship is funny. I think it's the level of energy that one has to put into this. Now it's changed, because you get what my essay in Lumber is about is that. Here I had all these carefully copied out passages that use the word lumber room and lumber and all that, but I could have written an essay, but then I got convinced Chadwick Healy to give me this $44,000 CD-ROM set of the English Full Text Poetry Database, which is a threatening, very frightening document to any scholar if you're tracing the history of word, because you know you're going to get hundreds and hundreds of new instances from obscure poets you never even heard of, and so how does that mess up your quest? And can your own kind of hobby of following that word survive all this new material?
I'm speaking to Nicholson Baker. the author most recently of a collection of essays, The Size of Thoughts, Essays and Other Lumber. Speaking of melancholy, I guess as soon as I got the book, the title was told to me over the phone. So I wrote it down in my notebook as The Size, S-I-G-H-S, The Size of Thoughts. And I thought, well, how nice. I'm sure they do, in fact, sigh. But in fact...
Oh, yes, The Size of Thoughts, The Tears of Things. Yeah. Maybe in the paperback I'll change it. Yeah. Well, no, The Size, what happened was I had written a couple of stories for The Atlantic when I was 25 and just kind of fizzled out as a short story writer and tried to get a job as an editor at The Atlantic and made a kind of presentation to the editor then. This was 1982, that The Atlantic, this was before Best American Essays, or the fact that it was before the essay tradition had really been revived, I think, in this country. And I said, we've got to bring to The Atlantic writers who use more metaphors per cubic centimeter. We've got a lyrical, light, complicated, philosophical, and I went on and on like this, and he said, well, like who? And I didn't know the answer to that, you know, so I just said, well, like me. And so I wrote The Size of Thoughts and Changes of Mind and Rarity about these kind of abstract philosophical subjects, but trying to anchor them with lots of a ferment of metaphors.
And so you had written Rarity before any of the novels?
Yes, The Size of Thoughts and Rarity and Changes of Mind are all... What happened was, and I felt that I had kind of done as much as I could with the essay form and the kind of things that I wanted to say, so I ended up going on to having a real narrator writing an escalator and doing that sort of thing, because it allowed me maybe to hold these somewhat essayistic ideas in a larger structure.
How interesting, because in Rarity, I detected the sound, obviously, an anticipation of the man who has been discovered in his peculiar novels too quickly and hasn't had a chance to simmer around in the culture, developing his extraordinariness in secret. The essay is really about how completely colonized the rare tends to be, discovered immediately, trumpeted, and turned not rare but frequent.
Well, it was written in 1984, and the mezzanine was written in 1987, but I think I was just talking about a standard human emotion. If you discover for some reason that when you're writing on a Rubbermaid spatula, clean Rubbermaid spatula with a ballpoint pen, you suddenly realize that this is a wonderful sensation, and that writing on the perimeter of your sneakers, that there's something about writing on rubber with a ballpoint pen is beautiful, is interesting, is worth thinking about. And then you exert yourself and actually write a paragraph about it that begins an essay. What have you done? I mean, you've somehow betrayed the private its privateness and its value to yourself, maybe. And I felt I'd kind of hoarded up all these things that I thought were interesting and private, but probably things that other people thought, but that I hadn't ever seen written about. And I somehow didn't want to give them away. And then in the case of the mezzanine, I just felt that I'd reached the age of 30 and I had a child, and I really had to start delivering them in bulk. You know?
So. It's funny, because I do sense now that you have, from book to book, the obligation to provide a certain kind of rarity, and that locating it is not that easy a thing to do.
Yeah, the bottom of the barrel suddenly turns out not to be there. It turns out to be false bottoms in the barrel. You can kind of scrape, and then there's a new area. I don't know. I think actually what happens is you get older and you write about one sort of thing in one sort of lyrical way, is that it just different parts of the world become interesting, And the things that seemed exciting, the really rapturous first paragraphs that I always like. I mean, there is a wonderful feeling about starting off in something, a short story or an essay that I used to love. That sort of thing changes, and you just end up enjoying maybe social detail or a different kind of metaphor or a larger structure that you can set in motion with several components. And so it doesn't feel like you're trying, you know, giving a further twist to an already dry towel or something. Not always, at least.
Does it seem to you that something died with Nabokov when Nabokov died?
Well, that's an interesting question, that something died. Well, the obvious thing about Nabokov is that he had a particular eye that nobody else has ever had or will have. He'd already done his great acts of vision are kind of they're sprinkled around in all of his works, and sometimes in an otherwise quite pedestrian story, there'll be this thing, so that it suddenly leap up a beautiful observation. I think that he had finished seeing, and I think in fact that we know how great he is now because he's done, and that it's up to us to the other thing that turns out is that it feels when you look at somebody like Nabokov that his particular camera has recorded everything there is to record, but actually it's only covered a tiny little micron-wide area of the surface of truth, and so that it's up to other people, many, many other people, to chart other areas, I guess. I don't know. I remember learning that he died and feeling that it was much too soon, that I hadn't – I was 20, I guess, when he died, exactly. And it didn't seem fair that I wouldn't be – at least have been allowed to live until I was 30 and had really lived a little and could see the areas in which he was good. But, you know, the things that I like about Nabokov aren't the things that – I mean, Panin, it seems to me, is a very loving book. And I made the mistake of reading a Kingsley Amis review of Panin. When the book came out, Kingsley Amis reviewed it, and it was the nastiest, most sneering. Here's a funny man, Kingsley Amis, you know, late Kingsley Amis, saying such ungenerous things and such false things about here's this stream of content. I mean, he was using big, stupid categories to put down a delicate kind of assembly of short stories that is loving at every turn. I mean, Panin is a very lovable character, and the bouncing of the ball when the son has rejected the ball that Panin has bought him and everything, and the loss of his teeth, and there's just 100 beautiful emotional things in that book. And I think he gets a bad rap as being this kind of brilliant stylist. He's not actually a brilliant stylist. His style is plastered on in a strange way. And what's really interesting about him is that he's a very intelligent man, a lovingly intelligent man, I think.
It's also, though, you see, I bring him up. Some listeners will know immediately why, because it seems to me that the love you have for Updike and the complicated feelings about him as well are in turn things that Nabokov has given to Updike and Updike to you, and that there is an ever less frequent appearance of writers who care for the slow and gradual accretion of word details that make a world, and that the loss of such books is the loss of letters in our time, that when people ask me, you know, what's the problem? I said, well, television isn't the problem. The problem is that a certain kind of book that really humanizes brilliance, makes brilliance acceptable, is disappearing from the world.
I mean, I don't know quite how to say that, because I would love to hear in greater detail if I fit in there, but I certainly think that writing that takes verbal textures seriously and writing that is kind of informed by a lot of reading is the writing that lasts. As long as there is the initial thing, which is that the person actually has something to say. I mean, I think in some primitive way that unless I say have something to tell you about the way motion pictures are actually projected, that they don't happen to be projected from reels, but are projected from platters, and that I can tell you that. That if I don't have that initial kind of discovery that I can impart to you, that no matter how carefully and with luck, you know, interestingly, beautifully even, I present the motion picture projector to you, that I won't be doing enough. I've got to have some secret, some truth, along with the verbal filigree, not for filigree is to, but the texture that I want it to have. I want it to have both. I want it to be true and beautiful, I guess. So.
Well, there must be a world, you know. That's why I think Nabokov, when he started writing books that would turn out to be entirely populated by ghosts, people who were no longer alive, as beautiful as those books were, they didn't have the concreteness. However, one felt that his work was always the brilliant recording of acts of light through veils, there was always something very concretely present. So yes, I agree with you, and yet I think it is the pleasure of these essays that they illustrate, that while they illustrate, say, the movement of the motion picture projector, they also enact the movement of the mind, which reveals itself to be somehow shaped like the movement of the new motion picture projector, you know?
Yes, I think probably my intentions are almost always introspective eventually, and that I want to be a realist about what's going on in my mind, and that I harbor this hope that what's going on in my mind is also going on in your mind, so that you will kind of recognize that we will have something to talk about, that I will have been saying something true about mental states that we both share.
I've been speaking to Nicholson Baker on the occasion of the publication of his book of essays and other lumber called The Size of Thoughts. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bucks.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.